everyone involved in putting this awesome event together. You know, if you're here, even if you're attending, you're part of this, and you deserve some of the credit. Thank you.
If you're here and you're not attending, that's a good trick.
Well, good night from New York. This was Off the Hook from Hope.
No, we're still on here.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. Oh, they live on for the best, expect the worst.
Is on you, and there's nowhere you can run to anymore. Yeah, there's nothing that you can do. Just consume, just consume. Stop me, I guess a friend or two, but no one knows me, and I'm not shy, my footprint is on you. Is there nowhere we can run to anymore? Is there nothing that we can do? Is there nowhere we
can run to anymore? Is there nothing that we can do?
This is Bill, and we are the Free Software Roundtable. We are broadcasting on Radio Statler. Normally, we are on WUSB, 90.1 WUSB. Let's see, FM.
Cillian.
This is Bob.
And this is Kupo.
It's quite unusual for Bob to be here. Usually, he's manning the controls.
Yep.
The WSB studio.
Yeah, I try not to say too much.
And on Radio Statler, I believe we are broadcasting live from Hope.
Yeah.
Yeah. I usually say too much, so.
All right. We will be rebroadcasting at 10 p.m., I believe, the normal third Saturday slot.
All right. With any luck, we will.
All right. And we're on every third and fifth Saturday of the month. Okay, so what's new at Hope?
Oh, jeez.
I just got here, so I think Bill, you're the one who should be asking most questions.
Oh, wow. Well, there's all kinds of stuff going on here. I've not really been to the talks. I'm kind of here to work the show, to help out with networking and stuff like that. And I think that's been working out pretty well. Kupo is here working on the AMD project.
Yeah.
The stuff that I've seen is mostly, I really like the electroluminescence display. There was a table of people that were displaying electroluminescent materials and explaining how you can sandwich them between clear plates of conductors, and you can actually sort of get addressable electroluminescent displays so that you can have, if you wanted to go to this extreme, you can create a luminescent display, kind of like an LCD display, which is just, you know, black liquid crystal, but this would be glowing, and it's the kind of thing they used to do in car dashboard displays, and it's like these kinds of things hold up for a real long time, I think, so you could create a really, you know, durable, persistent, very, very low energy consumption display, and you can do it yourself. You can fingerprint, you can screen print on glass, and come up with some really interesting glowing electroluminescent displays. Did actually see somebody here with electroluminescent wire on their clothing, so it kind of looked like an anime, kind of a black trench coat kind of jacket, but a little anime looking, and with all the traced outlines in
kind of like Tron or something.
Yes, you could do the Tron effect also.
Yeah.
It's very similar to that Tron effect. I think with Tron, the entire suit glowed to some degree.
Yeah.
Right. So there are a couple other things. There's a lot of hardware hacking going on live at the show.
Yeah.
A lot more than last time.
Yeah. There was like kind of one or two tables with soldering irons, and they did some circuit bending at appointed times. But there was a large area dedicated to hammocks, you know, just like people could crash out if they wanted to, which is really cool.
They moved to see
that kind of thing.
They moved a lot of the floor plan around. I think I like this floor plan a lot more than past hopes.
Yeah, the Segway tour lost out a little bit in terms of the floor plan.
You can't tell from looking at them. They seem just as crazed as they're driving around.
No. At Last Hope, there were like just ridiculous Segway crashes all over the place because they had lots of room. The Radio Statler booth was crashed into, I believe, by an out of control Segway.
Yeah.
That's why they moved in here.
Don't drink
and Segway. Right. So, if you're not, this booth is now a reinforced plywood with styrofoam. Styrofoam reinforced plywood. So I think we're pretty safe this time. There's also a caution tape around the booth to ward off any wayward Segways.
Because that'll stop them and they're out of control rampage. Well, so, I mean, we're here and we're all busy doing stuff, either attending stuff or trying to set stuff up. And I don't know, what interesting things have you guys seen at the conference that you want the world to know about?
Well, we've been running around a little bit, doing some interviews, which we're going to play during the show,
okay,
of some of the people on the floor, kind of, you know, asking people about their projects and what their moment is.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're going to cover some news, and then we'll play some of these interviews interleaved into the show.
But first, we're here at Hope, but does anyone know what Hope is about? Anyone listening? Do we assume our readers know everything? Maybe they've looked it up online already.
Well, so we've got two sets of listeners, right? We've got our normal radio guests, and then we've got everybody listening at the conference or streaming from the streaming the conference over the internet to wherever. So I guess our WUSB listeners, all three of them, would like to know about Hope. I'm just joking. I hope I'm joking.
College Radio.
So Hope stands for Hackers on Planet Earth. It's a conference that's sort of produced by the 2600 enterprises that produce the 2600 Hacker magazine that comes out quarterly. It's been around since, I think, the 80s. It's just a great lineup of speakers and how-tos and videos and music and movies and art and I don't know what else, but because I haven't had a chance to run around and see it all yet. And stuff like this, stuff like the radio.
Yeah, personally, I'm hoping the DVD is going to come out soon so I can catch up on all the stuff I'm missing.
Right.
So, what do we want to lead in with? Do we want to talk about Bilski?
Yeah, I think that's probably the most interesting development since our last show. All
right.
Obviously, we missed our last month because of some scheduled conflict at WSB. So we haven't had a chance to digest Bilski and get our opinions in. Basically, the quickest introduction is the Bilski judgment came through, and it's not what anyone expected. People were expecting to basically for this to be the end of software patents, and although the ruling kind of went in as people expected, it also included a big asterisk that this ruling does not really apply to software, which kind of preempts any of the fallout that would relate to software patents in particular.
That's not completely unsurprising, considering that I don't think the Supreme Court wants to be responsible for the breakdown of the American economic system in the middle of a recession.
It would be a big change. It would be dramatic.
Yeah.
So, what was there a rationale given for the that thinking this does not apply to software?
My understanding is that some of the opinions from the judges specifically mentioned that it should be really legislative branches required or should be involved in this procedure to change how patents are applied to software. So it should come from there and not so much from
really
from court cases.
So it's not the kind of thing where it's like, okay, feel free to send us another case and then we'll rule on it. And when it comes to software, it's more like, well, we really don't want to be involved in this and we probably would not accept the next case that came along.
That is my understanding.
Hmm.
I mean, one thing to take away from this is that it's not a big loss.
It would have been a big win.
It would have been a big win, but it's not a loss. It basically just, what it means is nothing has changed. And we all, because the judgment was so delayed, it was basically ruled in the last day of the current session of the Supreme Court, last case for Judge Stevens, right? And it was kept, the case was pushed down and pushed down because there was there wasn't a single clear consensus. If you read the ruling, it's very, a couple of judges agree on this point, a couple of judges agree on that, and there isn't a clear consensus throughout.
Well,
in particular, it's not. Well,
you never want to.
It's actually unusual for the court to do this.
Well, I learned a thing or two about Stevens, who's retiring now, that I did not know and assumed to be completely opposite. That he's always been a long-standing upholder of more of the computer rights in society. I had no idea the background on him. He was a cryptologist for the Army and some other stuff. He was very crucial during the Betamax legislation. I had no idea about any of these things. So if it was ever going to be a positive ruling for open source and IP law, it would have been while Stevens was on the board. We have no idea how Sotomayor and I forget the new Supreme Court justice that's being vetted now.
I haven't read the Sotomayor's, because she... I don't know, her vote didn't really count, but she did file some kind of motion, you know, on her own opinion, and it kind of was somewhat in line with Justine's.
She filed a brief,
perhaps.
Whatever it's called.
Whatever it's called, yes.
Yeah.
Judge Stevens himself, all of his brief is probably the most interesting one. It's extremely long. I think it's on the order of like 20 or 40 pages or something like that. And he agrees with the outcome. He doesn't agree with the
reasoning.
With the reasoning behind the outcome.
He agrees with the outcome. That's interesting because I know he's championed against. He's cautioned, not championed against, because justices aren't supposed to champion, really. He's cautioned against software patents for a while now.
Yeah, I mean,
and he predicted this when they first came around.
Yeah, I mean, he's progressive in terms of software related law. I mean, and it's going to be sad to see him go because he's kind of been crucial in this respect.
Okay, that was Bilski. What else do we have?
We got a good amount. We got SCO released the latest, those Linux code snippets that they claimed were copied out of, Unix code snippets that they claimed were copied with Linux.
So, same story, different day.
They actually showed the snippets now, and the linking in the code.
What I've heard, it's the same stuff that people have sort of debunked. Based on the link that we passed around before.
Oh, really? Huh.
It's all stuff people have seen before. It's very low-level stuff, not like high-level complex algorithms. It's like...
error code definitions, header file, and stuff like that.
Exactly. It's like, oh, look, the definition of this function call is exactly the way it is in Linux. It's like how you define the API, you know.
If you look in any college textbook on operating systems... you would effectively see the structure. So
that's interesting. Okay.
But basically what it comes down to is, yeah, they're very similar, but it doesn't mean that it came from SCO's Unix, if you want to call it that, because that's another question on its own. It could have come from another upstream project or, you know, from academia or some other upstream.
The APIs are not closed. I mean, the implementation may be closed, but APIs themselves are not closed. So include files, you know, your .h files that you have to define what a function call looks like, you know, totally separate from how it's implemented under the covers, I can't see any correct decision coming down saying that this would be an infringing work.
They went through that before years ago.
Right, yeah.
All right, so nothing new out of that arena.
It's the same kind of thing you'd expect from SCO. And now, what was the thing? McBride's brother is now like the big lawyer on the SCO's case. Who are the guys? Daryl McBride or
McBride? Yeah,
Daryl and Daryl.
And his other brother Daryl. Apparently, his other brother Daryl is a lawyer. I don't know the guy's name. But there's another McBride.
It sounds like they're two brothers driving around in jalopy with straw hats on.
Yeah, I think that's...
The McBride brothers!
If that's not what it's come down to, it's what it should have come down to by this point. These guys can't have any money to keep on going. They've got no case.
Well, you forget he keeps slipping the money every once in a while to keep up the fight.
Yeah. You want to mention...
Oh, I'm sure. Microsoft's found one way or another to slip them money through other organizations.
Sure.
Well,
for a while now.
Well, they've done it in the past. I'm not sure if they've done it since. I mean, because they kind of got caught red-handed.
They get caught red-handed, but really they don't have to stop. They never really get a slap on the wrist for it, so they just find a different way to do it. Or they foster, you know, it's as simple as them coming along and going, hey, why don't you try and use this technicality, or why don't you try this angle of attack? I mean, Microsoft's lawyers are just... They're sitting idle most of the time, unless they're being actively yelled at by the EU or something. So
if anybody out there who can file a lawsuit against Microsoft, please do.
Yeah, keep them busy.
There are a bunch of lawyers out there with nothing better to do than respond to your lawsuit.
I'm sure they've got lots.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you guys seen this word from ACTA?
What's that?
This is the consortium of...
The anti-counterfeiting trade agreement?
Yes.
Yeah.
No.
ASCAP or...
yes. ASCAP is what.
ASCAP.
That's the Canadian... Or what is ASCAP? Refresh my mind.
It's some kind of authors yield.
Is that in Canada?
Bunch of people.
No, that's...
Bunch of people whose job it allegedly is to collect or... Traced down who owns copyright and where royalties should go.
American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers.
Right. Emphasis on publishers, I believe. Although they do have a bunch of artists who are members. And they put out this letter soliciting donations from their membership for the purpose of... going after Creative Commons and who else? EFF. I mean, the most upstanding organizations that you can think of, on the basis of false information that they stand against copyright, which is really an amazingly ridiculous statement to make.
Basically, like in summary, what they're saying is that copyleft is undermining.
Copyright.
Copyleft is undermining copyright.
Not only that, it's exactly. It's more extreme than that. That anybody that doesn't agree with that is a zealot or a some sort of weird freak for not agreeing with them. Which I've been watching in sort of the blog space, especially Cory Doctorow was called like a nut job for advocating for public domain and open source and Creative Commons.
Hmm. So, and the big response by the Creative Commons is, hey, you know, we have a license, which is, you know, it is a copyright. We do nothing to undermine copyright. Everything we do is based on copyright. And, you know, some other words to the effect of, you know, we'd like to have an open and honest debate and, you know, trying hard not to say that they think that these guys have a screw loose. However, some other members of ASCAP supposedly have written in basically to say, you guys have a screw loose, and why are we members of an organization that's going off and doing stupid things like this?
You know, one must not forget that both the GPL and Creative Commons are intrinsically dependent on the copyright, and neither of those are organizations... obviously, FSL being behind the GPL, are going to fight the copyright system because that completely invalidates all of their license and a lot of their hard work.
Mm-hmm.
They're really out there, I think, more for fighting patents, mm-hmm. which is the bigger problem.
Really, kind of a stretch of the imagination how the EFF even gets included in this. I don't even understand. I mean, EFF is out there to help people assert their rights. It's really hard to figure how you could call the EFF a group that stands against copyright holders in any way. I mean, the flawed reasoning against the Creative Commons is that they have an alternative license so that people can take their material and say, I don't want copyrights, you know, enforced on this. People are free to use my material. I believe that we've heard in an earlier interview today that when you release a piece of work, it sort of has a default copyright on it, and people like ASCAP can sort of make money by pushing through people through all the legal mechanics it takes to find who's the owner of this work, and, you know, they'll collect royalties for things where royalties were never intended to be collected, just to, you know, as part of this process. If not actual royalties, then other fees. And if you have a clear license that you can put on your work that says, hey, I am the owner, and this is free for you to use, then it destroys their business model to some degree. That particular work, they can't charge fees and collect fees on. But the artist would have gotten none of these fees anyway. So,
possibly. I mean, for the majority of the cases, yeah. So.
Well, if somebody never intended to assert their copyright, ASCAP is not going to find them and start handing them piles of cash. ASCAP will collect fees.
Well, I think ASCAP can do negotiations on the larger scale. So if you're a radio show and you play 100% non-ASCAP covered music, that is, things that don't fall under the RIAA or whatever organization umbrella, or umbrella organization, and say is effectively all Creative Commons, but if you introduce even some music that is covered by ASCAP, they can kind of start going out for legal fees that don't cover only the music that was covered by ASCAP, but kind of the whole show.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, to some extent, you can say they're kind of poised, or it's kind of like viral a little
right.
bit, or their objective is viral. And so, if you dilute it too much, it might lose potency effectively.
Right, but again, this has nothing to do with money getting back to you, the original owners of the works, right?
Well, ASCAP does give money out to its members.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're an artist and you're part of the ASCAP organization, you will get a check.
Sure, but if you've got a show that's, you know, 90% stuff that's not covered by ASCAP, okay, those people, that 90%, they're never going to get a check from ASCAP, no matter how much they manage to collect based on, you know, on your work. You'll never get a check from them. So, you know, it's like they're afraid that maybe people will
put
together...
They're afraid of losing their revenue stream.
They're afraid of losing their revenue stream. They're afraid of losing the ability to charge money for things that they were never entitled to charge money for in the first place. And that's really, you know, that's really the threat that they feel. I don't see how they have any legitimate case, and so... They make up these falsehoods.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all agree it's completely ridiculous. And the Zero Paid website.com quotes the letter from ASCAP. At this moment, we are facing our biggest challenge ever. Many forces, including the Creative Commons, Public Knowledge, Electronic Frontier Foundation, and technology companies with deep pockets are mobilizing to promote copyright. In order to undermine our copyright, they say they are advocates of consumer rights, but in truth, these groups simply do not want to pay for the use of our music. Their mission is to spread the word that our music should be free.
The thing that strikes me about that statement and the overall tone about it is that they find it to be criminal for people to want stuff for free. Free stuff is awesome. So they're trying to draw this analogy that people that would like things for free or groups that would advocate giving things for free is bad, and that's their main point. That if it's free, there's no revenue and then there's no compensation, and that makes it criminal. And
if you can't charge for it, it's illegal.
Yeah, if you can't charge for it, it's legal. And I mean, we had that back in the day. Remember when you wander around with an MP3 or have Creative Commons music, and then you'd go, oh, where'd you get it? I downloaded it. Oh, I don't break the law. No, it's Creative Commons. No, I don't download music. I don't want to go to jail. And it's like, no, there's a gradient there. It's not just black and white.
Well, it's a complex issue, maybe. I mean, a lot of things that you can download do violate copyright.
Yeah, but
not
going
necessarily,
out and getting Creative
not
Commons
necessarily
music.
Everything. Yeah. Right.
And people need to know that there are alternatives to...
There are some free things out there. And the fact that there are some free things out there does not entitle you to download all the MP3s that you've probably got. Maybe iPod users are actually paying... for these things, but before before iTunes existed, people just did it, and nowadays, because of that, iTunes has come out and charged much less money for these things because you realized, hey, it's so easy. Distribution is so easy now. It used to be that record companies were distribution companies, and they actually performed a valuable service for people in making copies of music. Right? Artists got some money for making music, but the record companies could legitimately complain, could legitimately assert that they were being paid money for providing the service of reproducing and distributing that music. Now it seems like they really only exist to be a revenue stream for artists, or at least that's how they can legitimately claim to exist.
Yeah.
They really have no other legitimate purpose left.
I mean, I look at this also as them aggress, sinking their nails into the porcelain as they go down the toilet bowl. I mean, that's sort of... I mean, that's my one-shot sentence on the deal.
Yeah.
They're going to get more and more desperate the more and more revenue they lose. And so we're just going to see more of this behavior. It's inevitable.
Yeah,
because they got a good thing going. They want to keep it going, but it's not happening. It's not working. So.
And a lot of it, and to be honest, is the way the law is set up right now anyway. A lot of it is, theft of copyrighted material. But that's got nothing to do with the Creative Commons or the EFF. These are just convenient boogeymen that they can use to...
Hopefully get a law passed to prevent to keep their business interests rolling along. I mean, that's the end goal for them, is legislate themselves to relevance.
I guess everybody wants to be able to label somebody else as a bad guy. But there really aren't any other bad guys here except for consumers that they don't want to attack directly. Consumers who are copying music and movies pretty freely. And, it's not good to attack your consumers, so they're labeling somebody else as the bad guy. Somebody that they think won't stand up for themselves or doesn't have the resources to defend themselves.
Well, I mean, it's a multi-pronged attack. They're definitely not... They've not stopped attacking consumers, but it's not really working. I mean, I don't know who saw the recent Slashdot article where the RIAA paid out $300,000 to collect... Or was it something along $16 million to collect $300,000 from consumers. So they're losing money hiring lawyers... To pursue these people that are file sharing, but they were losing more money doing that than they would if they just allowed people to file share. The lawyers are now, they realize it's a sure thing, and they're making their money where they can. And the RIAA realizes finally that it's not really as effective as they wanted in stopping people from doing it. They'll catch one or two people, but they're not going to fund their business on lawsuits against file sharers at this point.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that RIAA is losing money to lawyers, essentially? Is that
yeah,
what you're
saying?
Yeah,
I mean, I can pull up the article, but...
The RIAA's own lawyers are sucking them dry?
Yeah.
God bless them.
Yeah. So maybe we have operatives. Maybe we have operative lawyers that we don't know about for Creative Commons, but...
No, they are managing to, I think, really nail a very small number of people who are... using things like BitTorrent and peer-to-peer file sharing services, not even realizing it, but some of them do realize what they're doing and just play dumb, but whatever. Some people are getting hit really hard.
Yeah. I was pretty close to the actual figure. It's $16 million. Paid its lawyers more than $16 million to recover $391,000. If they were doing it to send a message, the message would have received... So it goes into the details of the article and why it's a good thing for lawyers.
As always, it's working out well for the lawyers.
No, yeah, everything seems to be good for lawyers.
Yeah. No matter what happens. Well, they're the ones that make the law. You know?
Is our economy going to rebound based on legal fees? I don't know. I'm not sure that's what we want to base the economy on.
I can see some sort of weird stretched out system where everybody sued everybody and they're all making minimum payments on settlements to each other.
Right.
And we have this whole virtual economy set up of minimum payments on settlements.
Yeah, we have to work out a way where we sue other people in other countries.
We try that. I mean, that's why we formed the World Trade Organization, right? Well, we're still an actor.
And the rest of the world should just pay us legal fees to keep us going. Yeah.
Well,
what else do we have?
I think we should maybe go into the an interview with
Warren Gilson
on free software, which kind of ties in into some of these topics we're just covering. So, guys, at the the controls, can you cue that up for us?
I may pop out to ask them really quickly. Why don't you tell them a little bit about the interview that they're going to hear?
Well, what's...
It's cued, so can I just play it?
Deb Nicholson from the Free Software.
That was quite a description, Bill. I appreciate that.
So,
oh, yeah, this is Deb Nicholson.
Echo.
From... the Free Software Foundation. Are they starting?
And, all right.
Often we wonder if there's anybody listening. We're never quite sure. It's a small college radio station. Why don't you tell us what the FSF is up to lately?
So we recently launched a campaign called Working Together for Free Software. So, you know, the FSF is a little over 20 years old. The GNU project is a little over 25 years old. For a lot of our history, we've not been in a position to just sort of go to untechnical end users and be like, hey, you should switch to free software. And that's changed. We now have a couple of fully free GNU Linux distributions that we would recommend. And so now our task in promoting free software is to kind of bridge the gap for folks. Like, what sorts of software would you want to start with? Where's a good place to sort of get your feet wet? So that's our most recent campaign. We also just got news on the Bilski case, which is a business method patent case that we hoped the Supreme Court would use as an opportunity to narrow the scope of what's patentable in the abstract realm. And we'd hoped that would be great news for abolishing software patents, which are sort of the bane of every free software hacker's existence.
It can be very difficult to write software without infringing on or knowing whether or not you infringed on some random patent that's out there, right?
Right, and so there's what we call patent trolls, like folks that just collect patents so that they can sue people. And then there's also sort of the same...
Would you count SEO in that category nowadays?
Maybe. I don't want to give them any airtime, actually.
Okay, sure.
So there's that, and then there's also sort of the problems that are endemic in our legal system generally in the U.S., which is the most money wins, whether you're right or wrong.
Right. If somebody's mad at you, they hit you with a lawsuit and hope that you wouldn't have enough lawyers or you'd just be cowed by the legal threat and just fold.
Right. So that produces a chilling effect for smaller software projects that are just starting to have enough money to be worth suing, but not enough money to actually fight a legal battle.
And with Bilski, the Bilski case, it didn't actually set a precedent that you can patent software. It just kind of avoided that whole issue. So what avenues is the FSF pursuing, you know, to kind of stabilize that, you know, the software patents problem?
Well, there's sort of two things there. We have a lot of momentum from people who had been paying attention to the Bilski case. Some of the things that we've been doing are educating decision makers and legislators, hoping that we can sort of use this as an example to say this is already happening. The chilling effect that was mentioned in one of the opinions as if it was a possible negative future situation is already here. We've also been kind of, I think we're going to keep our ears out for other cases that might come up. That's going to be a while. And the court sort of said, like, we'd like to, you know, feel free to send us another case That's like loose, and I'm not an attorney.
In the Bilski case, did the FSF file an amicus brief, or that's basically your involvement in the in the legal procedure?
Right, and then we also we have a video called Patent Absurdity on our website, which is sort of an educational thing that can be used to sort of explain what is going on with patents and software.
It's a really really good video.
Yeah.
You mentioned promoting software, promoting distros. Is that this is a new area for FSF? I believe, right?
Well, new compared to like the 26-year-old GNU project, but not new. I don't mean we only started promoting distros last week. When I was saying as far as promoting free software, the thing is that now we're sort of looking at use cases and trying to draw a line more clearly for folks rather than just like general operating systems like, hey, OpenOffice is a great way to get started, or if you're a nonprofit and you're interested in switching to free software, here are a couple of things that we know work because we're a nonprofit. And, you know, so sort of drawing those parallels for folks and making it a little bit easier to get, you know, take that first step towards using free software.
It seems like I know of a lot of organizations that are very hesitant to make recommendations. They just sort of say, do general good things. but you guys might step in and actually talk about a particular Linux for the desktop.
Right, so the GNU Linux distribution that we're distributing on our bootable membership cards is Triskel. And there's a couple other distros that hit that mark, but Triskel is probably the most up-to-date for the Wi-Fi support because it's got the ASP9K driver integrated into the Libre kernel. So that makes it a really good distro to get started with. And it's got a lot of the same like GUI stuff that you would see in some of the other distros.
Are there any vendors that are, selling hardware with this pre-installed that you know of, or?
So we have been working with a company in China and trying to get Triskel pre-installed on a fully free laptop. The trick there is like the goal of a hardware vendor is a lot different than our goal. So that didn't go quite as quickly as we had hoped, but I think we remain optimistic that that may be one day we can say, buy this laptop, it is already running a distro that we like. So that is definitely a goal, but it's not, I can't say that yet.
Does FSF have any opinion on, like, I mean, there are some companies right now that are selling somewhat free Linux distributions with their hardware. But still, it's still not that easy to find. Does FSF have any opinion that they should install more of the free software, or do you want to see completely free and absolutely, no like gray line in between?
So obviously, our goal is 100% free software. If someone is using a proprietary operating system and they're like, oh, should I switch to OpenOffice even if I'm going to run it on a proprietary operating system? We would say yes, because there's a net gain of you're now using some free software, whereas before you were using none. So we do recognize that that's good. That's a good goal. As far as saying, like, we endorse it, we're going to advertise it on our website, it needs to be 100%.
Okay.
How did you come to be a part of the FSF?
So I've been here for almost 4 years. My background is all in organizing, political organizing. I've done a lot of work on free speech issues, access to the political process, civil liberties, and that sort of thing. And so that community is a little like almost what I call technophobic, or it was when I started there. And I always had this sense that a board that's like, maybe we should try using that internet thing, was maybe missing out on some of the things that were going on as far as like civil liberties and speech in the technological field. So when I saw the position at the Free Software Foundation, I was like, ah, that is the part that we, in the traditional progressive movement have been completely in the dark about. And so I was really excited for the opportunity to work on that.
All right. So are you able to get some cross-pollination there? You're able to make contributions to the FSF at the same time as making contributions to these other organizations?
How would I say that? I mean, we did this sort of thing saying, like, we would recommend CBCRM for nonprofit organizations. We have a member local in Boston that that sets up Drupal sites for labor unions. So there is a lot of like cross-pollination in Boston. There's people, you know, we have some of those conversations. We're not actually deploying like a free software geek squad to go to nonprofits and install stuff for them, but if someone was to do that, we'd
You're getting the web presence for some of these organizations that maybe they did not have before.
Oh yeah, as far as the fellow who's setting up Drupal sites for labor unions, most of them had not had a website at all before.
Wow.
So, so there is a lot of opportunities, and I think the Civi CRM is another really good example of stuff that is great for nonprofits to use, and they definitely understand like the price is right, and I hope that many of them are also kind of thinking about, yeah, I'd like to not have all of my data and all of my donor contact stuff in like locked in a database that we're, you know, like the vendor lock-in thing where we'll just have to keep paying.
Are you seeing a lot of similarities in terms of things like chilling effects between political speech and speech related to computers?
I mean, I think in a general sense, the way that a chilling effect functions is the same. It has some constants. One entity with a lot of money and can make a lot of vague threats. They don't even have to always follow through on that, but the function is the same. So it makes people feel a little less okay about saying certain things or doing certain things. So in that way, a chilling effect is a chilling effect. I'm more for the people. I'd like to see distributed power. I'd like to see individuals, kind of be their own captains.
Right. So I just remember certain things like during political conventions and things like that, there'd be kind of somewhat draconian police measures, sort of cordoning off areas, saying anybody in this intersection at the time we happen to show up is loitering, and sort of whisking people off to be detained but not charged, and odd things like that. I guess it's not really the same in the software world, but there are some... with Bilski, there's concerns of, software patents and lawsuits being brought. There are lawsuits that happen from time to time. I think we've talked before about Cisco and Linksys.
Yeah.
Just in compliance issues, where that's really a place, that's a very different situation, though.
That case is completely resolved now, right? Yep. So, like, there's no more contention between...
Really? No, we settled.
Has Linksys released source code for all their products?
They agreed to come into compliance. I'm not the staff person in our office who worked on that in detail, so I can't say too much on that, actually.
All right. This is something that I recall as a story that resurfaced from time to time because whatever had been agreed to hadn't actually happened after whatever period of time.
We worked with them. I think we'd been sending email back and forth with them for about 5 years before it was in court.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
as far as I remember, maybe we should move to another topic. What do you feel? Was it ACTA recently that came out against the EFF and the Creative Commons, saying that these are not good for artists in general? Have you heard of this?
Yeah, I don't think that was ACTA. I think it was the RIAA identified them as like enemies of content producers, or whatever their language is. Apparently didn't make their list because they're not really, that's not the kind of content they're, not doing content, like we're doing software, so.
You can't really apply the GPL to music or something like that.
Right. I mean, you could, that's, and there probably is GPL music. That's not the best use of the GPL, perhaps. but right, it's,
there,
you know.
There are other licenses. Does the FSF get involved in other licenses, or does it really just stick to the GPL? And
the only other sort of license that we're involved with is the GNU Free Documentation License. And so most of the Wikipedia stuff was under the GFDL for a long time, and then we worked really hard to make that compatible with the kind of the similar Creative Commons license, so that that content could be mixed and matched back and forth. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So we did, like, that's probably the most far away from software license that we've ever been involved with. And the GNU Free Documentation License for us was intended to be used for software manuals. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, so all of our books are under the GNU Free Documentation License, like the Emacs manuals and everything.
Mm-hmm. Great. As far as I remember, there was some contention with the Debian project with the documentation license. Are you familiar with this topic?
Yeah, that's old, and I'm trying to remember. That has to do with
I think the non-editable portions. Mm-hmm. There's some clause to that effect, which violates the Debian guidelines. Is that something you would like to see resolved from either perspective, or?
To my knowledge, like, no one's really had a conversation about that in a really long time. It's not something I'm involved with.
Okay.
So.
All right. Is there anything that we're missing out on in terms of what FSF is focusing on?
The only other thing is the piece of my work that I've been doing in the past year is we've organized a women's caucus to increase women's participation in free software. So the numbers of women involved in free software are really low. There was a study a couple years ago that put it at about 2%, which is way worse than the proprietary software world, which is about 20-something percent women. We organized first a mini summit and then a day-long caucus to look at why that is, and then we just recently put out a handful of recommendations for free software projects or people interested in increasing the number of women involved. So, so that's a little bit more about kind of getting more people in and not just.
Do you have an actual conclusion as to why there are fewer women involved in free software as opposed to commercial software?
There's a couple of different things. I'm actually going to give a talk at 6 o'clock that goes into a little bit of that, but some of the things about the free software culture where I think we value, like, the, you know, like, oh, I wrote, like, 20,000 lines and stayed up till 4 in the morning, and someone's like, ah, screw that, I wrote 25,000 lines and I stayed up till 5. When women, we live in a society where women do a lot of the homemaking stuff and are responsible for a lot of childcare, so that doesn't really mesh very well with that sort of a lifestyle. So, I don't know, maybe people do when their babies are waking them up at 5 a.m., like, stay up and do code, but I think
so
probably not.
Certainly free software doesn't require you to stay up at odd hours. You know, and you would think it would be very compatible with, you know, a flexible schedule, mm-hmm. You know, getting time whenever time happens to be available. But you're saying that there's sort of a culture that's formed around that.
Right, and I think that and no matter what the movement is, people tend to, whether intentionally or unintentionally, recruit people that look like themselves. So if I was walking by like a GNU Linux user group meeting that was happening, and I looked in and I'm like, oh, no one in there looks like me. No, whatever, you know, whether we're talking about race or gender or age or whatever, I might think, let's just take a pass. You know, that looks uncomfortable and... You know, so there's a little bit of that. I think there's also to the point where we have, like, kind of a stereotype of what a hacker is and what a free software person is, and you don't see a lot of women mirrored in that stereotype. And when you do, it's not always a very charitable image. So yeah, we're not doing a great PR job. Is what I guess that boils down to.
Is anyone trying to do? You hear sometimes people trying to defend quote-unquote hackers or the term hacker and, you know, make sure that, try to make people understand that it's not a criminal act, mm-hmm. you know, hacking. Does the FSF have any different or better approach than anything that we hear from time to time? And it seems like it's usually a brief effort that people don't spend very much time on, and then somebody comes on the news and, you know, does 10 times more damage than, you know, you could ever do in an hour yourself trying to fix things. Any solution to that?
I don't have anything specific. I mean, we definitely embrace the term hacker as, you know, someone that likes to take stuff apart, see how it works, and share it out with their neighbors and help them figure out the stuff that they're taking apart. Is Fox News asking us to help them sort out, like, how they use the word hacker? Like, no. So I think it's a good use of our time to try and get them to ask us. Probably not, but, you know.
All right. From time to time, people have suggested the idea of coming up with another term. Nothing seems to ever float to the top.
Oh, man. Some days we could be the office for communication of suggestions for other terms. Like, we get a lot of emails about, like, maybe you guys could use this, or what about this other word? Or, you know, like, just the thing about the Free Software Foundation and using the word free, that in English is the same, it's the same word for, like, a ratty couch at the end of the driveway that you're trying to get rid of, as it is for, oh, I've been in prison for 20 years and today I get to go out into the world. Like, same word in English. So we get a lot of suggestions in that realm. We've probably gotten ones about hackers.
Libre is maybe a little bit more accurate, but doesn't really get the point across.
More frequently and in the proper context, I think that's the best approach.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, is there anything that you'd like to say to promote the FSF?
Oh, well, I am our membership coordinator, so if you're not already a Free Software Foundation member, you should consider it, and you can go to our site, fsf.org, and there's pretty clear from the top there how to sign up and give us money. So,
okay. What kind of members is the FSF looking for, aside from people who will give money?
Oh, well, are you asking, do we have, like, volunteer opportunities?
Yeah.
We definitely do. We have opportunities for folks that are interested in helping out on campaigns, like the Defective by Design campaign that's primarily focused on educating folks about DRM. And we also have opportunities for folks that want to write code. All of that is on the Savannah Project, which is where all of the GNU stuff is held. And also conferences like this, like people that are chatty and want to represent the Free Software Foundation at conferences can drop me a line.
Has the FSF been sort of moving its focus away from actual coding over time, or not?
Maybe. Over the whole course of time, at one point, like, the GNU project was just Richard writing code. So in the sense that we're not just Richard writing code anymore, I guess we're doing a smaller percentage of code writing. We do still write some code in-house. We've had to do less of that over time because the things that we've wanted, like a free software database or free software shopping cart for the website, we had to write all those things from scratch the first time around because no free software alternative existed. We're doing a lot more like tailoring and customizing existing projects now. So that's
right.
Great.
So the rest of the world is catching up in terms of coding. There's a lot of more code out there under, you know, acceptable licenses, things that you feel good about using.
Right, and we're really super excited to be able to use things that have a huge community of coders and users behind it instead of like a Gordian knot of legacy stuff.
Probably, you know, you don't sit in an office full of people wondering what's going on with GNU Herd or anything like that.
No, we know.
Okay. Not all like sitting around like, oh, when's that going to come out?
No. We would all have asphyxiated if we were holding our breath on that one.
All right.
Yeah, I think that's it. One thing I have to just drop in is I really appreciate some of the new Web 2.0 projects, which either have been directly or indirectly inspired by the FSF, like Diaspora and
Libre FM.
Libre FM.
Yeah, that was We did a lot of looking at how to do web services, and GNU Social is actually my coworker Matt, who was here yesterday but isn't here with me today, is out in Portland doing a big meetup to talk about federated free software web services. So yeah, so that's a. But you know, like if Matt were here, you guys could find out lots and lots and lots of details about how that's going. But I can just tell you, it's going.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Welcome back.